some years ago when I was at the college, one of the assignments we were given was to produce a Plain Truth article on quality. And the thing that came to mind, of course, in those days was Rolls-Royce. So off we went to crew to the factory with all the equipment, and we were shown around the factory, and we managed to film certain parts of the assembly of a Rolls-Royce car. Spray painting, 22 coats of paint, all inspected by eye, which is far more accurate evidently than a laser. The engines are assembled. They're then all plumbed into water and petrol and everything else on the test bed and run for 24 hours, and then they're taken apart and a micrometer put on all the bearings to make sure they're within tolerance, and then the engine is reassembled. In other words, you know, quality is, it's a matter of using the best materials, it's time, it's effort, as opposed to most modern cars, which, if you've ever seen a modern car made, they're thrown together. But since they're thrown together by robots, of course, we end up with something that does actually last quite well. But it's not the same as a Rolls-Royce. What I want to go into is the preparation that goes in to producing something of quality and applying it to the Sabbath. Because, you know, God prepares, and this is what I want to look at today, the things that he actually prepares. And all the time, let's think of quality, and let's think of applying this same thought pattern to the actual Sabbath. And if you'll turn to Psalm 40, King David has something to say about this. In Psalm 40, and verse 5. You see, I was actually toying with the idea of introducing this sermon by saying, today I'm going to talk about yesterday and tomorrow. Because that's what it's actually about. You see, the Sabbath is a day for looking back. On one level, because King David says, many, O Lord, are your wonderful works which you have done. Now, as we just drove across the hills this morning, we were looking at those wonderful works. There was young foals in the field with mother horse looking on. There was one field with little calves. And coming down the track here, we had to stop to let the little lambs cross the road. And you just look at the creation out here at the moment, the sun shining. You begin to wonder, what's the millennium going to be like? Because this is so beautiful. What's it going to be like when it's really right? When everything is in working together. So David says, how wonderful works which you have done. And then he says, and your thoughts towards us, or one translation says, your plans for us, cannot be recounted to you in order. If I would declare and speak them, there would be more than could be numbered. In other words, looking forward, as Mr. Armstrong just said on the tape, and I haven't heard that tape for many a year, he's talking about the 7,000-year plan of God, which is 7 days, effectively. We are now, in case you hadn't thought about it like this, we are now in the very last, dare I say, seconds of that preparation day. Maybe the last minute of that preparation day. We're almost at the seventh day when Christ comes. And we have 7,000 years, the 7,000th year, where man is free from governing himself, which he simply cannot do. If we think of that future 1,000 years ruling and reigning with Jesus Christ and having our part in the creation of the God family, and a vital part of that plan, of course, is the weekly Sabbath. But it's not just the Sabbath. God prepares everything. I know in the past, I can think back to sometimes when you've had one of those weeks that you don't want to remember, and the Sabbath literally happens. You simply collapse in bed on Friday night and wake up on Saturday morning and think, ah, it's a Sabbath. But there's been no preparation because you've literally ended up exhausted on Friday evening. Now, God plans everything. If you think about the first 5 days of creation, he took the earth, which was without form and void, covered in clouds, totally useless. Tohu and bohu, as it says in Genesis. And he created day and night. He got the landmass out. He covered it with vegetation. But when he came to day six, this is the preparation day now. He's got the mass there. He's got it all up and running. But now he starts creating living beings. He creates the animals. And then, of course, he creates man. And right at the very end of that, of course, he then creates the Sabbath. In Genesis 1:26, I think we all know this one, So then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, including spiders. Got to get that one in, haven't I? In verse 27, it says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So God completed his preparation day by creating man. And then he says in verse 31, and God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. What he was saying is, this is quality. We now have a bee flying around by the looks of things. Oh, it's a bumblebee, it's okay. You see, talking about the creation, that thing is technically impossible. Mm-hmm. If you ask an aeronautical engineer about a bumblebee, he'll tell you straight, it can't happen. This thing is about 3/4 of an inch in diameter, with the tiniest wings that you've ever seen, and it's now causing great confusion. Well done. He's now got into the greater environment to do his job. But again, that's a miracle. It can't happen. Can't fly. Technically, that thing can't fly. We saw within our garden last week that it was almost as big as the little wren that lives in our garden. It was so big that when it landed on the plant just tipped. And it was going up this one plant, flower by flower by flower. And the wings on it were not even half the size of the width of its body. And yet it buzzes around quite happily. I think God makes those things to show us his sense of humour. So Genesis 2:2, it says, on the seventh day God had ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in that he had rested from all his work which God created and made. The first thing, if you think about it, the first thing that man saw when he opened his eyes was perfection. He was in the garden, or God put him in this garden, that was absolute perfection. It was the finest thing that God could produce. There was no plastic bags floating around or oil spills in the river. It was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And this is what he saw. He saw the works of God. The work that God had done, in actual fact, helps reveal God's mind to us. Oh, we just saw that bumblebee just now. It's an absolute miracle. That had to be designed. It didn't just happen. It had to be designed. And that's not the only one. There's a whole raft of bumblebees, from little tiny ones to great big clodhoppers of an inch and a half in diameter. And they all fulfill a purpose in a great big system. It's an amazing system. And it's all quality, and it's all thought out. And do you know what? It's lasted 6,000 years. Even Mrs. Bowles' spiders. They are a miracle, these things. They are absolutely stunning when you look at the way they're made. They are absolute quality. You don't see a shoddily made spider. So the first thing that Adam saw was beauty. It says in Genesis 2:9, out of the ground the Lord God had caused to grow every tree that was pleasant to the sight. You know, God could have made trees any old way. They could have just looked grey. They could have looked drab. You know, the fruit could all have looked ugly, and the flowers could have been gungy grey. But no, it's not. It's beautiful. And then it's practical. It was all good for food. And of course we had the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Everything was prepared, what for? For the Sabbath day. And that's when God got together with them and undoubtedly gave them his plan, gave them his law, explained to them why they were there, what they were going to be doing. And then he stood back. And Satan entered. And of course we all know that it went uproariously wrong. And once it had gone wrong, it set in motion that plan, which of course we are now privileged actually to be witnesses of, the death throes. It's just about to go. I don't know if you noticed in the news this week, but there was one time this week when one political pundit was saying the euro's got 24 hours. The euro could have crashed this week, and by shenanigans they've managed to give the breath of life to it, but for another few months. They haven't solved the problem, they just put some paint over it and made it look nice. suddenly staying alive became hard work. You know, it says in Genesis 3:17 that God cursed the ground. He says, "In sorrow shall you eat all the days of your life." Verse 18, "Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to you, and you shall eat every herb of the field, and in the sweat of your face shall you eat bread, until you return unto the ground." You see, taken out of this beautiful, perfect garden, slung out, an angel there with a great big sword to stop him getting back in, and that angel, I guess, would be there right the way through till the flood. Well, that's a tourist attraction. Yeah? And that went right up to the flood. In fact, if you turn to Genesis 8:21, after the flood, God changed it. Genesis 8:21, it says, "And the Eternal smelled the sweet savour," this is the sacrifice that Noah had made, "and the Eternal said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, neither will I again smite any more anything living as I have done." He'd wiped out everything except what Noah had actually in that ark. And verse 22, it says, "While summer remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night, shall not cease." And I was talking to Mr. Bowles about that, and we were just wondering, why does he say that? Could it be that just before the flood, that they were having a problem, that the seasons were maybe a little bit mixed up? You know, last winter, we've got a big plum tree at the bottom of our garden. It's actually not in our garden, it's just at the back of our garden, but it nicely overhangs our garden so we can claim the fruit. In January, it was covered in blossom. In January. At the end of January, just as the fruit was setting, we had a tremendous frost, and it killed all the fruit. This year, we were into April, and there was no sign of life on that tree. Now, you know, there's 3-4 months involved there, and the seasons have gone completely wacky. Maybe this is what made the problem they were actually having then. But the key point here is God got everything ready by the end of that sixth day. A perfect physical creation in which to feed and nourish the beings of his, the grassroots of his family, the human beings that he was actually going to work with. And then he rested. So then we have the preparation for the preparation day. Much later in history, God rescued his people Israel out of Egypt. Keep in mind that God could have made the whole process an awful lot simpler. The Egyptians could have been struck down with some plague and just all dropped dead. And Moses could have said, "All right, let's go. Line them up, let's get out of here." Walked up north, kept along to the coast, and just walked up into the land of Israel. 2-3 days. No problem. The Israelites had been slaves. I think it's something else we've got to try and remember and get into our heads here, is the situation that they had, right? The Israelites had been slaves for 430 years. They had been away from their land for all this period of time. They had lost the Sabbath. They'd probably lost virtually all of God's laws. Try and think of it this way. If we were the children of Israel today, coming out of the land of Egypt, our forefathers would have gone into the land of Egypt during the reign of Henry VIII. Right? That perhaps gives you some idea as to how long ago this took place. Long before Ephraim and Manasseh came to greatness in the 1800s, started the road to greatness in the 1800s, 200 years later. So, you know, you must realize how long these people had been exiled from their own land. So why didn't God just do it the easy way? He called Moses, poor old Moses, you know, got slung in the river, rescued, brought up, taken into Pharaoh's court, ended up a top general, according to Herodotus. He was the top general that conquered most of the lands that Egypt actually controlled. And then he has this altercation, killing an Egyptian, flees to the mountains, sacrificed for 40 years then, he's chasing sheep around the hills. 80 years old. I feel very young suddenly. At 80 years old, you know, God appears to him and says, "No, I've got a job for you." And we all know the burning bush, and of course he goes back in there. We know the whole story, don't we? And we come to the plagues. Why all these plagues? What for? I mean, come on, it looks like these plagues lasted up to a year, one after the other. It was total devastation on Egypt. I mean, Exodus 8, if you turn to Exodus 8, verse 22, let's just go over a couple of these things here. Because it's quite incredible what happened. Exodus 8, verse 22. He says, I will sever in that day the land of Goshen, in which my people dwell, that no swarm of flies shall be there, to the end that you may know that I am the Eternal in the midst of the earth. I will put a division between my people and your people. Tomorrow shall be the sign. In other words, the Israelites had gone through the first three plagues, and then, deliberately, God then says, right, now the land of Goshen is separate. They will be free, and the next seven plagues are going to come on the Egyptians. To show who what? To show that I am the Eternal in the midst of earth. He was showing the Egyptians and the Israelites. In fact, these plagues were equally for both. They were both having to learn who was who, and who God was for and who God was not for. That's why the plagues were organized the way they were. I mean, when it gets so bad, it almost sounds like this government minister the other day that handed over his job to his new conservative chappie and made a joke of it and said, you know, welcome to your new job. There's no money. Well, there is actually money. There's approximately £2 trillion worth of debt. That's what they've inherited, this government. Which is another story to watch in the news. I'll tell you, it's all piling up now for this final event. We are literally in God's clock. We're in the last 20 or 30 seconds of the sixth day. Exodus 10 verse 7. Pharaoh's servants came to him and said, how long shall this man be a snare unto us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Eternal their God. Don't you know that Egypt is destroyed? No, it wasn't quite destroyed. They just had the hail, and then the locusts came. Now, I've actually seen a small locust plague when I was down in South Africa over a limited sort of space. You can hear these wretched beasts from a mile away, chomping. Just, you know, like your kids. You put food on the table and pfft, it's gone. Well, this is just like a locust. Everything goes. Everything goes. You're left with stumps coming out of the ground, if there's anything left of the stumps. Exodus 10, verse 15, and they covered the face of the whole earth so that the land was darkened. And when they swarm, they can be so dense they will cut the sunlight down quite appreciably. And they did eat every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left, and there remained not any green thing in the trees or the herbs of the field throughout the land of Egypt. And if you study into this, you can actually put this exactly the time of the year when this happened, because it says that one crop was destroyed and the other crop actually hadn't come out of the ground. So you can actually put this into a season. What God was doing here was going through all these plagues to separate the Israelites from the Egyptians, to show each group who was who, and who he was for, and who he was working with. And then, of course, we come to the 10th plague, which starts off the holiday cycle with the Passover. Why did he go to all this trouble? Well, if you turn to Deuteronomy 5, you're going to see. Because when I read this, and I came across this when I was studying for this purely by accident, and it just hit me like a sledgehammer. It's a restatement of the Ten Commandments, Deuteronomy 5. And he said, and remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Eternal your God brought you out from thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, remember all that he did. Therefore, the Eternal your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Those 10 plagues and all that happened afterwards, the Red Sea being ripped open and going through, the Egyptians being destroyed and so on, were all done to re-establish the Sabbath day and God's holy days. And we'll see this now as we go through. This is the importance that God puts on the Sabbath. This is how the planning that he put into it. Turn to Leviticus 22. Turn to Leviticus 22. And verse 31. You see, this is what God was trying to get across to these people. Unfortunately, they were carnal people. They did not have God's Spirit. And of course, that's what we're going to be keeping in mind this weekend, with Pentecost, the coming of God's Holy Spirit. That changed everything. And if you remember what Paul said, all these things here, all these Old Testament things, happened as examples for us. These poor people went through all this lot so we could learn. They didn't stand a chance. They couldn't understand. Even when Christ came, they killed him. They couldn't get it. It's not that they didn't get it. They could not get it because they don't have God's Spirit. You can't obey God without His Holy Spirit. It's as simple as that. So we take the more earnest look at this because this happened for us, that we learn a lesson. And he says, therefore, you shall keep my commandments and do them. See, that's the crunch. I am the Eternal, verse 32. Neither shall you profane my holy name, but I will be hallowed among the children of Israel, because I am the Eternal which hallows you, that brought you out from the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Eternal. This is what he was trying to get across to these people with these miracles and so forth that were going on. Then he leads them out of Egypt, leads them into a dead end with mountains on both sides, the sea in front, and the biggest army on the face of the earth right behind them. They could hear the thunder of the horses' hoofs and the chariot wheels clanking. But in between was the pillar of fire and separating them, holding them back. Now that in itself should have told them there was something really tremendous happening here. We're being protected. But of course they were obviously panicking. And then of course you have this mighty wind that comes and the sea's all blown away, ripped apart. It looks like the sea in that area is something like 600 feet deep. And a couple of 3 miles wide. So it wasn't just a little puddle. And they go through this lot, watching this water towering up, very much like the Sikh going into Petra. And you go through there and the rock towers up on either side. Must be quite spooky. And then they come through the other side, and then this lot come charging across in their chariots. And God doesn't just destroy them. He pulls the chariot wheels off, which you brought up the other week. Why? So that the Egyptians would know that I am the Eternal. Because you see, everybody that's ever lived is coming up in that resurrection, that big resurrection, the White Throne Judgment period. And these Egyptians will know. They will know that the Eternal was God. Right? But the Israelites didn't. That's what Christ said, didn't he say to the people? He said, the people of Nineveh will come up and judge this generation. He said, the Queen of the South will come up. The people from Sodom and Gomorrah will come up. Because they would not accept Christ. I mean, that is stunning. But you see, they were never going to get it. All this has happened for us, and it's happened as a record that will be used throughout the 1,000 years, and particularly through the White Throne Judgment period. Where anybody starts any nonsense about, oh, well, our age was this and our age was that. You can go right through and say, well, look, this is what happened here. This is what happened here. Oh, this lot, same. Nothing changes. You never got the point. Because you couldn't. It only happens when God pours out his Spirit on all flesh. Then they understand. But it all goes back to the Sabbath. Exodus 16. Let's look at Exodus 16. See, the reason the Sabbath is so important, there are several reasons. The big reason is it's a memorial of creation. You look back at what God has done. He's created an earth. It is so resilient. I've got to smile. We have an oil spill at the moment in off the shores of Louisiana. Now, I'm not belittling it. It's serious, right? It's bad. And it's looking like it's going to be going on for a while. And it's a disaster. But you know what? If things go the normal way of oil spills, within 2 years, there'll be no trace of it. This world is so resilient, it doesn't seem to matter what we do to it. Hiroshima and Nagasaki were blasted with atomic weapons during the war, right? They weren't clean bombs like we have now. We've now got hydrogen bombs where you can blast an area, destroy everything within 50, 60 mile radius, and within a couple of months you can just go in there and take over. Or if you want to be really clever, you can use a neutron bomb, which just kills everything living, doesn't destroy the buildings. We're really very good at destruction. Excellent at it. All this was done back here to re-establish the Sabbath, because this Sabbath points back to God as creator of a planet that it doesn't seem to matter what we do, it bounces back. But on the other hand, it's focusing our minds forward, because we're looking at that seventh day of God's plan. Because that's when everything's going to be different. And first of all, we'll be different. Kings and priests sorting out the mess. Recreating. And it seems to me almost certain we'll have to recreate. Because all the fish in the sea are destroyed. For a start. Most of the plants we've got today have been so perverted with breeding and the technology they use to muck about with genetics and so on. It's got to be recreated. Incidentally, talking about genetics, you see in the post this week, we have created life! And I thought, that sounds a bit suspicious. And sure enough, they haven't actually created life. They've taken an already living virus or whatever it was, bug, bacteria, whatever. And they've taken some of the stuff out and they put some chemicals in. And it shows the resilience of God's creation, that this thing still lives. But you've created life. No. Let's go back to the Sinai. Exodus 16, verse 1. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is behind Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. So there was like 6 weeks out of Egypt. And the whole congregation of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. I mean, think about it, come on. Just 6 weeks before, they'd gone through this period of the plagues. They'd seen all the miracles that God had done to get them out. They'd seen Egypt totally trashed. 6 weeks in, they're moaning, Israelites. And the children of Israel, verse 3, said unto them, woe to God, we had died in the hand of the eternal in the land of Egypt, where we sat by the flesh pots, and where we did eat bread to the full. And you have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger. I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. You know, if you've got slaves working for you, you just don't give them rump steak. You know, they get the bare minimum to keep them alive. And in another place, they go into the cucumbers and the leeks and the garlic and all the rest of it. Yeah, okay. Verse 4. Then said the Eternal to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. You see, what God was trying to get across to them, and he's getting across to us hopefully, is the fact there's only one way to do things, his way. And it's not a matter that we all... I know when I was at college, I went on a visit one time, We were talking primarily to the husband. The wife was sitting over the staircase. It was like this. The staircase was like right into the lounge, and she sat on the bottom stair, and you could feel the vibrations from this lady, and she let rip. Ah, you people at Ambassador College, you're a bunch of clones. You know, you're all the same. You all comb your hair the same. You all dress the same. All the girls have got long hair. You don't think for yourselves. You see, she misses the point. It's the character that's being developed that makes us want to be like Christ. That's the bottom line. God doesn't want free thinkers. His way works. That's why he went into this preparation time of preparing an earth that is fantastic. In spite of all we've thrown at it, all we've sucked out of it, all we've destroyed in it, it still functions. Although the way we're going, we might be getting a bit close to tipping. But he wanted to prove these people. Are you going to live according to my law? Verse 6. And Moses and Aaron said to the children of Israel, at even, then you shall know that the Lord has brought you out from the land of Egypt. And in the morning, then you shall see the glory of the Eternal. For he that hears your muttering, that he that heareth your murmurings against the Eternal, and what are we that you murmur against us? He's saying, look, you're not getting at us, people. You're getting at God. But again, they didn't get it. And Moses said, this shall be when the Eternal shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full. for that the Lord hears your murmurings which you murmur against him. And what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Eternal. He's pointing to the people and says, you know, you're not moaning at us. You know, you're moaning at the great being that's brought you here. And Moses spoke to Aaron, say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Eternal, for he has heard your murmurings. And it came to pass, as Aaron spake unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked towards the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Eternal appeared in the cloud. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak unto them, saying, at even you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Eternal your God. Now, this could be kind of important to us at a time not too distant from now. Now, what I'm interested in is this. These guys were given manna. And that's what it means. What is it? Because they didn't know what it was. It was tiny, like the hoarfrost, which I would imagine would be small, like a couple of millimetres across. And they had to go out and collect this. But it was obviously a quality product, wasn't it? It was a quality product, because it kept them going 40 years. On top of that, no ordinary chicken, quail. Now, if you've ever had quail, you see, there's a thing with quail. Because they're so small, you cook them in 5 minutes. If you've got an open fire, all you've got to do is spatchcock it, open it up, stick a skewer through it, hold it over the fire for literally 5 minutes, it's cooked. And the meat is out of this world. It's succulent, it's got a slight gamey taste, and you think you can pig out on them. And I'll tell you what, if you got to the third one, you'd be pegging. It's really rich. It's a really rich, rich meat. It's absolute quality. Years ago, I was given some. I was doing a job... actually working with Desmond Groves, the photographer in Harrods in London. And he jokingly said, oh, you're coming to your Passover, aren't you? I said, yes. Hey, so you need to buy some quail. I said, what, on my salary? Oh, no problem. He picks the phone. Send me out 2 dozen quail, and he puts the phone down. So I went home with this box of these things. I mean, these things are a ludicrous price. Even today, you pay £3, £4, £5 for this stupid little thing that's a bit bigger than a blackbird. You probably get 6 or 8 mouthfuls of meat off it. That's the quality God gave them. He could have given them chickens, or guinea fowl maybe. But you see, it would have taken too much to get 3 million odd people starting to cook something as big as a guinea fowl. You know, it becomes a mammoth operation. You know, whereas a little quail over the fire, barbecues are good. And it came to pass that in the even the quail came up and covered the camp. They didn't even have to get out of the camp and collect them. They were knee deep in the things. And in the morning the dew lay around on the host. And with the dew that lay had gone, behold, upon the face of the wilderness, there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoarfrost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, it is manna. Now that's not quite right, because in the Hebrew it says, what is it? That's what the word manna means. It means, what is it? Yeah, you got what's it for breakfast again, you know. This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons. Take ye every man of them which are in his tents. Now, an omer, I tried very diligently to find out what an omer is. It seems that for every 6 books you look at, there's 7 ideas. It would appear to be something like 2 to 3 litres. So if you can imagine a 2 to 3 litre bottle of milk, you've got to fill that for every person. So it would have taken a couple of hours probably to collect the stuff. However, there's a small problem. Verse 19 of Exodus 16. And Moses said, let no man leave it until the morning, notwithstanding they hearkened not to Moses. But some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms, and it stank. And Moses was right dischuffed. Yes. So whatever this manna was, it was obviously something incredibly fresh. It was incredibly rich. And if you didn't eat it, the bugs did. Right? So that told you something about what we should be eating today, doesn't it? You know. We've got lettuce growing in a little shelter we have in our back garden, and my wife's been quite happily nibbling them off to school for a lunch. And if you're careful, you can store it to the second day. the actual heart will keep the second day. On the third day, it's all gone limp. And you buy shop-bought lettuce in its little plastic bag. It's been irradiated. It's stuck with nitrogen to make sure nothing gets in it. And if you notice the base, it's normally got this like a brown gungy stuff on it. Whatever that is, it doesn't look very appetizing. That lettuce, you can leave it in the bottom of your fridge for 2 weeks. And just take the outer leaves off and the middle still tastes like a lettuce. But nourishment? But you see, this stuff is so rich that the worms would really go for it if you didn't. And you'd have to store it. You see, you couldn't just leave it lying around, as you'll see. But if you left it lying around, it melted in the heat. So these people were deliberately taking this stuff and storing it in some cool place. And in the morning they opened it up, and not only was it full of worms, but they got the whiff off it as well. Verse 21, and they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating, and when the sun waxed hot, it melted. So you see, they were being put into a routine. You get up in the morning, the first thing you'll do is you'll get out and collect the manna. It's then brought back and processed into bread or whatever they were actually making out of it. And if you didn't do it quick enough, it would evaporate. However, verse 22, and when it came to pass on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much for bread, 2 omers for each man, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses, and he said to them, this is that which the Eternal has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which you will bake today, and seethe that which you will seethe, and that which remains over, lay up for you until the morning. In verse 24, and they laid it up until the morning as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath unto the Eternal. Today you shall not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there shall be none. And you just know what's going to happen. It's like these cartoons. The other morning we were watching a Tom and Jerry. You know, we were all sitting there, one after the other, saying, now you watch this, that'll drop, yeah, there it goes, boom, splat. You know, you just know what's going to happen. It's just the same with this lot. You know, you read one verse, you just know what the next verse is going to say. And it came to pass that went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. And the Eternal said to Moses, how long refuse you to keep my commandments and my laws? See, there's a point here. If you just make a note of Deuteronomy 6, verse 7, this is one of my scribbles this morning. You always tend to modify these things at the last minute. God tells us to teach our children, and my wife's nodding there. God teaches us to teach our children when you're going out, when you're coming in, when you're out on the path, when you're out in the field, when you're doing housework. Just get little things into them. You know, God does the same with us. We know that the Holy Spirit is a water, for instance, is a type of the Holy Spirit. Now, if you've got any plants around your house, every time you put water on those plants, you should be reminded of that, because if you don't water that plant, my basil the other day, I went into the kitchen, I've got a basil plant on the kitchen. I don't eat very much of it, I put some through salads. But I like going in the morning, it's giving a good... And the smell just fills the kitchen, it's beautiful. But poor old basil, he was all lying on his side, dying. Pour some water on it and very slowly, during the day it came back up again. We have toast every day. It's bread. Bread is God's word. We need that every day. The daily bread. These things are all given us as types. And this is what he was trying to do here with these people. But making it plainly obvious. But they had to bake it on the Friday. So that they weren't wasting a whole lot of time on the Sabbath actually doing heavy cooking. Yes, verse 29, or verse 28, and the Eternal said to Moses, how long refuse you to keep my commandments and my laws? You know, when are you guys going to get the point? See, for that the Eternal has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you the sixth day, the bread for 2 days. Abide you every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So then they got the point and they rested. You see, what a way to get the point across. There was time involved in the collection. It had to be done at a specific time. it had to be done in a specific way. They had to then cook it, or whatever they did with it, make it into bread of some sort. It would have to be done. The ovens would have to be lit. It would be hard work collecting, you know, picking up something that's 2 or 3 millimetres in diameter, unless it was 6 inches deep and they were scooping it up. But anyway, it would have been work. They'd have to have really gone at it. They had to collect it when they were told. They had to prepare it how they were told, or they simply went without. You couldn't be a lazy housewife, because if you were lazy by 11 o'clock in the morning, all the manna you got had melted into a glue, and you starved. But not on the preparation day. That's the miracle. They were being taught about the Sabbath. And then in Exodus 31 and verse 13, again, you know, God says, "Speak you also unto the children of Israel, saying, Verily my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Eternal that does sanctify you, that separates you from this world. You're mine, you're my people, I'm working with you." But they never really got the point. And if you go through and you read all these books, you go through all the men that God worked with, they got it. King David got it. But did Joab? "You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, it is holy unto you. Everyone that defiles it shall surely be put to death, and whosoever does any work therein, that shall be cut off from among the people." There were certain things they were allowed to do. You were allowed to untie your animals and take them out to water them. There's all sorts of little things that could be done, but it was a different day. It was completely different from what the rest of the week. It says, "Wherefore the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Eternal made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." And that's the key. He went to all this trouble, all the way through from the start of the plagues, right the way through to this manna, to get the point across. This is the Sabbath. It's not important. It's vital. Because if you get the Sabbath, you look to a creator and not to some green goo in a pond that was full of ammonia and was struck by lightning at just the right time to create life in a one cell, and that one cell grew over billions of years into all the creation you see around you. As I said to one gentleman at one conference one time, who was an ardent fan of evolution, I said, "I really do admire you." And he looked at me, because he knew where I was from. He said, "Why?" I said, "Your faith is so much stronger than mine." And he didn't get it. Now, to me, it requires more faith. It requires more faith to believe that everything came from one little of life. That flower, which is so beautiful, came out of the same little bit of green slime as I did, and you did, and this tablecloth did, and the molecules and these bits of wire did. All came from that one little itsy-bitsy slime. That requires faith. Or, I don't know what. It's much easier to look at it all and say, this was all designed. This was all prepared for us. Because, you know, right at this time, God's preparing for that special Sabbath. And we are part of that preparation. And this is what makes it so personal. I was going to say scary. It's not scary. But it's frightening. The seventh day of that plan is a Sabbath. Men will be taking a rest from government. All government will be controlled by the family of God. We are now living at the end of this sixth day. This preparation day. That God's preparation day, right? Revelation 19 verse 7. Let's go to Revelation 19 verse 7. "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honour to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife has made herself ready." We could change that just slightly and say, "For the marriage of the Lamb is almost come." We're close. We're very, very close. And if you go into verse 8, "And it was granted her that she be arrayed in fine linen, and clean and white, for the white linen is the righteousness of the saints." And what is righteousness? Well, all thy commandments are righteous. These people who have this white linen, right, are the people who are obeying God's law, keeping God's Sabbaths and holy days, and doing all the other things that God requires of us. But learning God's way takes time, and it also needs quality time. It takes effort, especially when you're up to your waist in crocodiles, to take an hour out for prayer or an hour out for Bible study, or dare I say an hour out for meditation. It also takes resources, and we've got the resources. If you go onto the website, there is so much stuff there. You can name your subject, it's there, and it's in the process of change at the moment. It's going to be much easier to find stuff very shortly, and there'll be even more material going out. We're not short of material. It's how we prepare ourselves, how we use the time we've actually got. Revelation 19 verse 9, and he said, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he says, these are the true sayings of God. You know, believe this. This is what it's all about. Now if you turn, with that in mind, if you turn to Philippians 2:12, we see another scripture that goes together with this situation here. It says, wherefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. I was thinking about that. You know, a few years back when Mr. Armstrong was around, we had churches all over the place. We had, 1,500 ministers, churches in every country. Nobody would have, well, very few people would have had very far to travel to a church. We were down in Johannesburg with 750 people, a regional director, an assistant regional director, we had a pastor, we had preaching elders, local elders, about 24 deacons, 750 people in the congregation. It's a fabulous social club. You know, we had big picnics every Sunday, we had dance every couple of months. And then God said, right, I'm going to shatter this now. And now where are we? At the end of a computer, in a farm in the middle of America. In an internet cafe, maybe somewhere in Nigeria. Maybe one person stuck out in Australia listening to this on a tape the day after, because this is happening where, you know, you're in your bed or whatever. We're on our own, folks, aren't we? I mean, even us here. We've driven 300 miles to be here. As far as I know, between here and there, well, there's one other person on the south coast. There's nobody else. There's nobody else that thinks the same way. We have got to work out our own salvation. We've got to want to be tuned in to the service. We've got to want to go into that website and find the answer to the problems that we've got in our lives. We've got to do it. Before, I always laughed at the Spokesman's Club manual where you had Mr. Wolverton's depiction of all the kids in the classroom, and the teacher's got the funnel and he's just pouring knowledge in, you know, into each of the kids in turn sort of thing. It doesn't work that way, does it? We've got to work it out ourselves. And I don't know about you, I was just talking with several people have mentioned the same thing recently. Years ago, it seemed to me that as you come to Passover, oh boy, did you have problems. About 2, 3, 4 weeks before Passover, the car conked out and there's problems with the kids. It just seemed the problems like pile up. There's no break anymore. It's constant, isn't it? You almost go into a week, you know, asking, and you're praying to God, you know, can you just give me 1 week off? Yeah. Matthew 24:45 is one thing that Mr. Bowles has mentioned several times, brought up at the conference. This is vital. It says, who then is faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give them meat in due season? We don't go to the day of Pentecost and discuss child rearing. The day of Pentecost about the Holy Spirit. We don't go to the Feast of Tabernacles and go off on some other tangent. We talk about the kingdom of God. That's meat in due season. This is what it's all about. And I think we've been doing that. You go back over some of the sermons that are there. Now, God prepared the promised land for his people. Nothing happens by chance. It wasn't a question of, look, just walk up there and beat the stuffings out of those people and then you'd take over. No. Exodus 23, verse 20. God says, "Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Provoke him not, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my authority is in him." Right? Now, who is the angel? Was it the physical leader? Was there a spirit angel there? But they were to be very careful how they treated what they were told to do. It says, "Behold," it says, "but if you shall indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy unto your enemies and an adversary unto your adversaries." And drop down to verse 28. You know, God does not mess around. Have you ever been chased by a hornet? I have. I had I was about 15 at the time, and I had a 22 rifle, a high-powered 22 rifle, and a friend of ours were out shooting. This was down in what was then Rhodesia. And down near just up the river, there was a hornet's nest hanging in a tree. And this was several hundred yards away. And of course, in my humility, I turned to my friend and says, "I'll bet I could take that down." And he said, "I'll bet you can." So I let rip. And sure enough, down it came. And unfortunately, it landed on a rock. And it burst. So you can guess what happened. We hightailed it and dived into the river. Which wasn't a very clever thing to do either, but never mind. There was Bilharzia in the river. And as I hit the water, something hit me in the face. And we stayed under the water, swam as far downstream as we could, and we came up. And my face started to swell. I'd been stung just below the eye. And my friend led me back to the doctors, and my whole face had literally swollen. I couldn't see. I had to be led one hornet sting. And let me tell you, it was like a red-hot poker going into my face. And it was agony for about a week afterwards. One hornet. Now then, what God says is, "I will send hornets," plural, "before you, that shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite from before you." I'll bet it would. They wouldn't stop running. "I will not drive them out before you in 1 year." You see, it's planning, it's preparation. If he had driven out all the people in one shot, by the time the Israelites had come in, the land would have been degrading. And behind our house, when we moved in, was a field in which there were trees. Then the field changed hands. The animals were taken away. 3 years later, you cannot walk through it. It's 6 foot high in brambles. It's totally trashed. If somebody wants to take that land over to turn it into something useful as far as crops or animals go, it's going to cost a fortune to get rid of those wretched brambles. I suppose all you could do is mow it down and put the goats on it. Have to buy some goats off Adele here and get them up there, because I believe they can eat brambles. But you could not drive a tank through this stuff. Quite amazing. It says, "I will not drive them out before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against you." You see? It's planning. "But little by little I will drive them out from before you until you be increased and inherit the land." It's planning. It's preparation. God is preparing a place of safety for his people. And if you Revelation 12 verse 6, we all know the scripture. It says, "The woman fled into the wilderness, into a place prepared for her." Being prepared. And Revelation 12 verse 14, it says, "To the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent." So for 3.5 years, these people that go here, hopefully us among them, are free from Satan, which is a very interesting concept. And they are protected, but they're nourished. They are nourished. Now, I think it was Philip and I were talking about this. I think he said to me, if they moaned and groaned and got manna and quail, if we're real good, what are we going to get? Well, it could be. I think I brought that out a few weeks back. It could be that that area is turned into a mini paradise. If you read Isaiah 35, it does give the indication there that the desert blossoms as a rose before the coming of Christ. We can hope. We can hope. But we know that God can do it. We don't have to worry about can he do it. I like the idea of quail anyway. Now, as a matter of interest, the eagle's wings bit has raised a lot of speculation over the years. If you just make a note of Exodus 19 verse 4, it talks about, it says, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you out unto myself." I mean, they walked, didn't they? They walked, or they rode a donkey or whatever. There were no 747s. The eagle's wings is inferring protection. Not something you want to tangle with as an eagle. Forget the beak. Watch out for the claws. I was close one time to it wasn't actually an eagle. It was one of the big members of the hawk family down in South Africa. I was having my lunch at the side of the road as I used to when I was travelling. I was watching these, they call them dassies down in South Africa. It's like a rock rabbit. It's not really a rabbit. It looks like an oversized guinea pig. Bounces around the rocks and disappears. Because these are great food for birds of prey. And I saw this. It was only about 15 feet from where I was eating. And I was watching this thing. I caught the movement at the corner of my eye as this thing came in with its feet outstretched. And it grabbed this poor little thing. And you heard the bone crunch as its feet went in, claws went in. And it just went like that. And it was stiff. Completely crushed in one movement. The power in those legs. They walked, but they were protected. When it comes to preparing for the end of the age, you know what? Guess what? It's the Sabbath again, isn't it? For those who go through the tribulation, the Sabbath will become a real problem. Mr. Armstrong had a lot to say. He gave a sermon. It's on the website, 11th of December 82, on the mark of the beast. He says, "Now they call the Sabbath the Lord's Day. They say the church changed it. And the church did change it, the Roman Catholic Church. But God did not." And he goes on down. He says, "You Protestants have to admit the authority of the Roman Catholic Church that is branded on you when you observe Sunday, because you have no other authority for Sunday than that of the Roman Catholic Church." And he goes on down. "Now what commandments affect your business? How many of our people have had to change their jobs? That has affected their job and their earnings of a living and the buying and selling because of the Sabbath. Now the Roman Catholic Council of Laodicea, which is 636 AD, they passed this, quote, 'Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath.' They called it the Sabbath. They didn't try to say it's the Protestants that began to call Sunday the Sabbath. The Roman Catholic Church never did. Rather, they said at the Council of Laodicea, 'Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, resting rather on Sunday.' But you see, when the church called them anathema for Christ, the government of the Holy Roman Empire then tortured them and put them to death. So you see, the Sabbath is still coming into it again. Mr. Arms says, no question about it. And that's what happened. It has happened. Now, just in case you think that it's not being prepared, news, May 31st, 1998, Pope John Paul II issued an apostolic letter about Sunday keeping entitled The Lord's Day, which has important implications to Sabbath observers. In his papal letter, John Paul appealed to the authority of the fourth commandment. I'll have a bit more to say about this tomorrow, because in actual fact it's the third commandment, according to the Roman Catholic Church, which sanctifies the Sabbath day to give legitimacy to Sunday keeping. He also advocated civil enforcement of a Sunday rest. You see, God's prepared the end time. He's told us through Mr. Armstrong what's going to happen. Mr. Armstrong explained the mark of the beast is Sunday keeping. And the people who go into it, the Laodicean era, will have a problem with this. And it would seem, according to what I believe he said one time, half of them could have to give up their lives to prove to God that they will obey him rather than the civil authority. And here we have the preparation. It's all falling into place. God has prepared the kingdom for his people. John 14 verse 1. "Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house," verse 2, "there are many mansions. If it were not so, I wouldn't have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. You and me. And all the other people who are trying to be faithful to God. This is what Christ says. I'm preparing an office for you. Where is that office? It's in the holy city. That's what Abraham looked for. He looked for the holy city. That's where the first fruits go. For eternity. Forever. Never, ever, ever to get a yellow form or a pink form, depending on where you live, saying, terribly sorry, your services are no longer required. Mind you, today they don't do that. They send you an email or a text, don't they? I go to prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And when we come to the holy city, it won't just be Jesus Christ that will be there. God the Father will be there as well. That's all being prepared. That was prepared from the time of Adam. It just takes 7,000 years to get there. Matthew 25, verse 34. Then shall the king say unto them on his right hand, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world, or from the throwing down of the foundation. It's all been prepared. It doesn't matter what aspect you look at. Prepared for you, because you know God prepares. King David gave us more direction in Psalm 15. We actually sing this one, don't we? Psalm 15. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness. Works righteousness, keeps the law. Does what God tells them. And speaks the truth in his heart. Who does not back with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbour. Nor does he take up reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honours those who fear the eternal. He who swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. He who does not put out his money for usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. Oh, that some people in this world would believe that one. Mind you, if they did, it would collapse the economy, wouldn't it? Well, it's going to collapse anyway, so they might as well give it a try. You know? He who does these things shall never be moved. God has a plan for everything. It's all been prepared. It doesn't matter what aspect you look at. God created the perfect environment for mankind, and he prepared it with great care. He created the Sabbath for man. He went to great lengths to re-establish his Sabbath with those people. He's prepared the promised land for his people. God is preparing a place for his people to be protected during the tribulation. He's preparing a place for us in his kingdom, so that we in turn can teach others and bring the whole of humanity at some stage into God's family. And we now live in that preparation day. Every week we get to keep the Sabbath. And it's, in some ways, when we realise the importance of it, we then start to get this idea, just as we're preparing for that Sabbath every week. And by the way, if you're working all day Friday, the preparation day starts at sunset on Thursday night. We can see from the example of how God worked with the Israelites that we should be preparing for it. It shouldn't just happen to us. If we had to work on Friday, or say, remember, preparation starts on Thursday night. We can pre-prepare food, get the house tidy, plan it out, make it a joy. It's a special day that's been given where we not only haven't got to work, we're not allowed to work. So we can do some of the other things. If you've got children, take them out and show them the creation. It gives you time when you can sit down and do a bit of study, because sometimes in the week it you've got to be honest, sometimes in the week it just doesn't happen some days, does it? The Sabbath is a memorial of creation, you know, get out and see it, show the children, walk in the garden, look at the creation, marvel in its detail, its beauty, enjoy the rest. It's a time of physical renewal, but it's a time of spiritual renewal. More time for prayer and study, to push this world and all its problems aside. And everybody you talk to at the moment seems to be up to their waist in crocodiles. Let's face it, we really are. Even in our shattered condition, God has made it possible for his people around the world still to have access to spiritual food. And here's the witness, a bundle of cables and a laptop computer. And anywhere in the world, if people know where to look, they can listen to what's being said here. There's also a tremendous blessing. Turn to Isaiah 58. Isaiah 58 and verse 13. Isaiah 58, verse 13. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath day, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the eternal, the holy of the Lord, honourable, and shall honour him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasure, nor speaking your own words, then shall you delight yourself in the eternal, and I will cause you to ride upon the high places of the earth, and will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. The mouth of the eternal has spoken this. This is how vital a Sabbath is. If we get this right and get our attitude right on this day, then we're going to be in that position for all eternity of being eternal, being very God, being sent out on a job. You know, you look in the Old Testament, you'll see Christ. He'll say, I am the eternal and there is none like me. Hey, on a minute. No, he was the Word, wasn't he? He was only the Word. And he said, I am the eternal. Why? Because it was as if God the Father was there. That's what he said to Thomas. You know, do I need to show you the Father? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I do exactly what he tells me to do. And that's the key. Christ didn't come to do his own thing. He did what the Father said. That's the tremendous example that he set us. As I said at the beginning, the Sabbath day is a day for looking forward. Many, O Lord my God, are your wonderful works which you have done. Go look at the creation. We're blessed here. I suppose if you live in a city, it can be very, very difficult, especially if it's a noisy city. But even then, if you just look at your own body, which is an absolute miracle in itself, it was created. And again, for all the things that we've done over 6,000 years to try and destroy ourselves, we're still here. It's a day for looking forward. When King David says, you know, he's basically said, you know, if we were to try and think of all the things that you've planned for us, we couldn't put a number to them. And then back in Isaiah, it talks about when we get to the end of the 7,000 year plan and the holy city comes down, all this 7,000 years won't even be remembered. It won't even be recalled. We won't even talk about it. Because what's up front is so immense, so awesome, and so it just overrules and overwrites everything that's been done in the 7,000 years. When I can say this in the right way, all that comes out of this 7,000 years is the family of God. From that point on, whatever happens is so different that the 7,000 years is just wiped. It's like a CD is thrown in the bin. That's the end of it. That's astonishing. We're looking forward to that other Sabbath. We're looking forward to this last day of God's plan when we get our chance to be God. You know, Mr. Armstrong said that, you know, God, they're creators. God and Christ are creators. Maybe we'll get a chance to do some of that creating, because it almost seems impossible that there isn't going to be recreating to be done, because things are going to be so different in the millennium than they are now. As I say, we've messed up all the seeds. I don't think you can probably get a really genuine tomato plant anymore, or a proper potato or whatever, lettuce. They've all been messed around with to produce more of this and less of that and live longer. It's incredible. Right now, we're in the final minute or even less of that preparation day. So it puts this urgency on us. And let's avoid the attitude that the Laodicean has of, you know, my Lord delays his coming. You know, Christ isn't delaying. There's delay no more. The passage of time is on now. You look at the news. You look at what's happening. Anybody who thinks America is coming out of the mess that it's in now is beyond being an optimist. It's totally impossible. The debt factor is into so many trillions that it's... I don't think they could print that much money if they had several printing presses going day and night. It's now come to light. Our debt is something like £2 trillion. Not 0.8 of a trillion or 800 billion as they said it was. Again, lies, cheats, frauds. That's what the previous government's been. And don't hold your breath, because the new one probably ain't going to be any better. Just different. It's all coming to a head. And it's coming to a head very quickly. So this is our part in the preparation. We've got to make ourselves ready. And one of the ways we do that is by doing what we're doing now, meeting on God's Holy Sabbath day.